Hi, and welcome to the Overshoot Podcast,
a 9-part podcast series by the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, IASA.
My name is Frederik Hocke.
And I'm Francesca Gandolfo.
We are climate journalists and founders of Kurzschluss Redaktion based in Vienna.
In this podcast, we will interview 9 experts in different fields to understand how we can cope with a world post 1.5 degrees warming.
Each episode is a little sneak peek into the topics of the Overshoot Conference hosted by IASA in Luxembourg, end of September.
The Overshoot Conference will discuss in depth how we can navigate the risks, trade-offs, and opportunities that come with overshoot scenarios.
We are very excited to be able to talk to some of those experts in advance and hope you enjoy listening to our conversations.
Thanks for tuning in. Hi and welcome back. This is the 5th episode of the Overshoot Podcast. Today, we're virtually joined by Deborah Roberts, who's currently in South Africa. Deborah is an expert in urban sustainability and climate change adaptation. She works at the intersection of science and policy. She was instrumental in establishing the Environmental Planning and Climate Protection Department and later led sustainable and resilient city initiatives in Durban, South Africa. Deborah has contributed extensively to the IPCC on several occasions, and she has also been named one of the 100 most influential people in climate policy twice. At the Overshoot Conference, Deborah will chair the conference theme Climate Impact Reversibility and Irreversibility. So let's dive right in. What's your understanding of Overshoot, Deborah?
Thanks, Francesca. And it's great to be with you here today discussing these important concepts. So let's try and make it simple so that we've all got the same background. If we're talking about Overshoot, and here I am going to draw on my experience in the IPCC or Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, where essentially we've defined overshoot as a process by which we might exceed a particular temperature goal, and that could be 1.5 degrees of global warming, 2, maybe even 3. But the important thing is not just the exceedance, is that the overshoot definition includes the ability to return to that particular temperature limit or goal. So if we were to exceed 1.5, we would then imagine a process by which we would peak emissions, and we would be able to return to a global warming level of 1.5. And those two trajectories of exceedance and return have great policy relevance, but very different sorts of policy relevance. So as we talk through this notion of what is irreversible, what is reversible, we need to bear those two trajectories in mind.
So what does it mean exactly in this context, reversible or irreversible climate impact?
So let's take our first trajectory. So for the purposes of our discussion today, let's take a temperature goal of trying to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. We move into a period of exceedance, which means the world warms beyond that on average. And what we showed in the 6th assessment cycle is literally every tenth of a degree matters, which means as you move past 1.5 to 1.6 to 1.7, your levels of impacts begin to increase. The frequency, intensity, and duration of extreme events begin to increase. And so because of that increased pressure on the planetary system, the anticipation is those impacts could cause changes, some of which may be irreversible. So let's think about what might be irreversible in that scenario. We could get at that increased level of warming certain species becoming extinct simply because it becomes too hot. The conditions exceed their niche requirements or their habitat requirements. So species may become extinct. We may see a particular ecosystem also becoming extinct. And currently we have a whole host of ecosystems which at our current levels of warming, sitting at about 1.2 currently, are already at risk. So we've got our warm water corals, we've got our coastal wetlands, we've got our rainforests, we've got our polar and mountain ecosystems. So these are ecosystems that could go extinct under these high levels of warming. Now that's irreversible. There's nothing as irreversible as going extinct. So you can't reverse that. So that's the concept of irreversible. You could also get state changes or tipping points during that period. So for example, I mentioned rainforests are an at-risk ecosystem. We could find, for example, in the Amazon that under those higher levels of warming, that amazingly diverse and rich ecosystem, tropical forest, could in fact dry out and become more savanna-like. Now, it might be very hard, even if we return to global warming levels of 1.5, for that state change to be reversed, to move a savanna back into a forest. So again, that would be an irreversible change. But there may be more hardy ecosystems, for example, where if we were able to peak emissions and limit the time at which we were at the higher temperatures and return, may be able to bounce back. So that would be more reversible. If you look at our sixth assessment cycle, we spoke largely about these impacts on ecosystems because that's where the science is available or was available at that time. But there's already discussion that we could have socioeconomic impacts that are equally irreversible. Because if you look at a continent like Africa, we've got a very high dependency in terms of our lives and livelihoods on our natural ecosystems. So for example, if the warming climate had an impact on our vast grazing lands and turned those into a more arid environment where grazing wasn't possible, that could cause state changes in the livelihoods of the itinerant people who utilize those grazing lands for flocks of livestock and so on. So we could get concomitant changes in the socioeconomic system, which would be also difficult to reverse. Whereas potentially people in urban areas where there are greater resources, more infrastructure, more resilience, they may be more hardy under those conditions. So there may be a degree of reversibility there.
Who is actually most affected by the impacts of an overshoot world?
Well, we speak quite clearly to that in the sixth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's vulnerable communities. So those who have been least responsible for the current climate crisis are most at risk. You know, so people directly reliant on land and ocean systems for their survival, you know, small-scale fishers, small-scale farmers, vulnerable and poor communities in urban areas, vulnerable ecosystems. As I've indicated, we've got a whole host of ecosystems that are currently at risk. So ironically, it's all the vulnerable in the world, both in the natural and human systems, who are at most risk from overshoot because they don't have the resources or the resilience of those, you know, who may be wealthier or better placed politically, who can move away from the impacts. You know, we showed in our assessment, there are people, you know, there's certainly climate migrants, but those are generally the middle class who will move. Whereas you get an immobility lock-in for people with lesser resources who can't move away from the impacts. And so this is the problem, is the systems that are least responsible for this problem are going to be the most impacted. And that's the huge injustice in the current problem we face.
You're based on the African continent yourself in South Africa. Are there any changes that you see on a ecosystem level or a socioeconomic level already now?
Well, we haven't gone into that definition of overshoot, because if you look into the policy space and the Paris Agreement, what we committed to as the social compact is that we would come together as a global society to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius. But we would also be ambitious, so we'll have a stretch goal, and we will pursue limiting global warming to 1.5 relative to those pre-industrial temperatures of 1850 to 1900. So according to that definition, we haven't yet entered into a period of overshoot. But we are already seeing, because of the current levels of warming at 1.2, a change in the extremes and both the intensity and duration, which obviously have had consequences now for things like health. We've seen an increased spread of malaria mosquitoes, of cholera, of extreme heat impacting on millions of people on the continent. So what we can witness are the impacts of increasing temperature. The problem is we believe that as that temperature gets even higher and we move into what we've identified as the dangerous zone, because remember, 1.5 doesn't mean the world's going to suddenly end. What we're saying with the science is you're moving into a zone now where you're still experiencing impacts and extreme events, but these could now take us out of the realm of just risky scenarios or dangerous scenarios into high risk to high levels of danger. So you're upping the ante every time the temperatures increase beyond 1.5. So in terms of our definition, we're not yet in a world of overshoot, although we do seem to be barreling towards that, because remember, that's an average over 20 years, that 1.5. And we must also remember that regions are warming differently. So the part of Africa I come from is currently warming twice as fast as the rest of the world. So some parts of the world may get there faster than others. So we're not technically an overshoot, but our experience already of the current levels of warming are showing the devastating impacts. You know, so for example, in my own city in 2022, we had really extensive flooding. In fact, I had virtually a torrent of water running through my house. During that period, lives were lost, property was damaged, often irreparably in some cases. And that was three times as likely to occur because of the impacts of climate change. The problem is, once we move into that world beyond 1.5, these things continue to ramp up, the impacts become more lasting, and in some cases, as we've discussed, become irreversible.
I think that's a very important point that you make also, that the 1.5 increase is not going to happen equally around the globe. Here in Vienna, where I'm based, and where the conference will also take place, or just outside of Vienna in Luxembourg, we're also already at an average of plus 2 degrees, I think, so well beyond the 1.5 degrees.
Exactly.
What difference does it make whether global temperature stabilizes or goes back down after overshoot? Why is it important to talk not just about how much the planet warms, but also how long we stay above the certain temperature thresholds?
So again, if we think about our trajectories and the fact that as we move into exceedance above 1.5, which we've shown will take us into these higher risk zones, obviously, if you peak emissions at a certain level, so let's say for the purposes of our conversation, we peak emissions at a level where the global average surface temperature is 1.7 degrees higher than the pre-industrial temperatures were. The longer you stay there, the longer these vulnerable ecosystems and vulnerable human communities are exposed to those more extreme impacts, more intensity, longer duration, greater frequency. And of course, that will have greater impact. So if you and I were standing together and I pushed you over, you'd fall to the ground with a nasty bump and may come away with a bit of a bruise. If I did that 10 times, 15 times, it would have more and more impact until eventually, you know, that it would be more difficult to get up potentially. And this is the same kind of thing. What we will be doing is the number of punches that these ecosystems and communities will get will be more consistent. You know, they will have to endure this longer duration, the greater frequency, the greater intensity over a longer period of time. And of course, that's going to have a devastating impact on ecosystems, on economies, on societies. And that's why it's really important, once we peak, to limit the amount of time we spend there, and that we return as rapidly as possible to a global warming of 1.5, which then takes us into the second trajectory, which is the return. And what we showed in the sixth assessment cycle is that may also be problematic. Because if the urgency is to return to 1.5 as rapidly as possible, we would need to work at scale on carbon dioxide removal in order to achieve that, which could have all sorts of implications. For example, large-scale afforestation in places where it shouldn't be, you know, taking over grasslands and turning them into forested areas in an attempt to suck up carbon, which could have impacts on ecosystems, but also on the communities associated with them. We could see large-scale BECCS, so bioenergy, carbon capture and storage. So large-scale production of crops to generate bioenergy, which on a continent like Africa could deeply compromise both water security and food security issues. So the problem is, the response itself may also have impacts for these vulnerable natural and human communities. And so you've got a huge range of potential impacts that come from this period of overshoot, not only in terms of the temperature exceedances, but also then in terms of our interventions to attempt to return to 1.5, which we must, because we know staying at the higher temperatures will have greater impacts for humanity and ecosystems. But we've got to be critical about how we affect that return, which is why we must minimize the level of exceedance and minimize the amount of time we spend at those higher temperatures to reduce the kind of impact some of these responses might also have.
Thanks so much. That's a really tangible example that you gave previously with knocking me down. I'll remember to be very nice to you when I meet you, so that won't happen. I think also the last part of what you just said really shows why it's so difficult to plan and project what's going to happen in the future and how to adapt the best way find the best solutions, because there's just so many factors. Like you said, it's not just about we don't know exactly what's going to happen at what level of temperature, but then also if we try to adapt, and that brings other challenges again. So how do you even plan in these scenarios that are so uncertain and with so many factors?
Well, the fact of the matter is, and I mean, I've been a local government official for 30 years, is we always plan in eras of uncertainty. What is happening is there's increased uncertainty now that we have to think about. So effectively, what has happened is the risk landscape that we need to work with has expanded. And I think that's the important thing about this particular convening is, number one, we're going to delve into this idea of overshoot and its impacts. But I'm hoping our discussions will help us identify what that expanded risk landscape might look like. You know, what are the possible scenarios in terms of overshoot, in terms of where we likely will peak emissions, in terms of how we might respond, in terms of trying to return to a particular level of global warming, to understand what that might mean generally, but also specifically in terms of our various regions. So you and I find ourselves in the same kind of scenario. The places we live are experiencing greater impacts because our levels of warming are different to the global average. And I think that's important, is to scope out that risk landscape, to begin to identify what solutions we are currently using might in fact be useful, that we can extend under those various scenarios, but also which responses might fall off the table. You know, do we need a new tool set? Do we need a new pattern of development which is responsive to these higher levels of warming, that is able to deal with the impacts that might come from our responses? So, you know, I'm not scared of uncertainty, because life is an uncertain thing. And in local government, you know, one has to deal with that uncertainty. So I think we get, scared of the word uncertainty unnecessarily, because you and I don't know what's happening tomorrow, but surely we'll both get up out of our beds and, you know, engage the day with energy and vigor, even though we're not certain what will come. For me, it's important to talk about this expanded risk landscape, but also to be open to the fact that standard tools might not work. So I come from a biodiversity background, and there's a lot of attention given to things like nature-based solutions, ecosystem-based adaptation. My real worry, just on the basis of the science I've articulated here today, is that many of those ecosystems that are important to us, so for example, think of coastal zones where a lot of communities are planting mangroves in order to protect coastal areas. Now, these are coastal wetlands which may not survive under the higher degrees of warming. Is, you know, will that option still be available to us? Will that nature-based solution still be operative? If it isn't, what do you do then? Do you replace it with grey infrastructure? Do we go seawalls? We know those potentially also have negative impacts. So to think through the value chain and the systems impacts of what this higher level of warming, what the responses might mean, so we can think about what tools we keep, what new tools we may need, what options stay on the table, what don't, are there different patterns of development we might need? And I think that for me is the conversation that we seem hesitant to open. Currently, there is a very limited societal and political debate around the issue of overshoot, I think because of the political connotations of it. And I think we've just got to be realistic. I think it's irresponsible, you know, given vulnerable continents like Africa, not to be talking about what overshoot might bring. So that for me is the important thing, is to begin talking about what this new future that we've never experienced before might hold, and how we might work our way through it, because the world is not going to end in 2030 if we don't limit global warming to 1.5. We will move on. We will move on in a suboptimal way. Vulnerable people and vulnerable ecosystems will be at risk, and we need to have a game plan for that. We need to think about safety nets where we can. And for me, that's the important conversation to be having now.
What is your secret to doing that? Because I find it very frustrating that, as you said, the science is very clear, very compelling. It says exactly what is going to happen, what needs to be done. Why does it not arrive at politics? How can we make science more compelling? What's your secret to making that happen?
I think we've got an even more challenging situation now, in the sense that politics and money are starting to come together, which I think is creating a new dynamic that we have to deal with. But the question is, how do we get it back on the agenda? The fact of the matter is, if you stand back, you know, if we put ourselves on the moon and looked at our little blue dot, the majority of people in this world are still lacking basic development, access to basic services, you know, simple things. I've just spent 2 weeks in Kenya and had the privilege of visiting informal settlements, Kibera, Gorogocho, Muruto in Mombasa. And you can see these are places where just the fundamentals are not yet in place. Clean water, decent sanitation, reliable energy, energy security, basic health. And I think the problem is we've become so focused on carbon. And remember, you know, put yourself in a situation where you've got to engage with fellow practitioners working and living in informal settlements. You're talking about a gas no one can see, no one can smell. It's hard to make that relevant. But we spend so much time talking about carbon that we've lost sight on development. And for me, I think we need to see change in our argumentation. I think we've got to put development back at the center of absolutely everything we do. And that applies as much to the Global North as the Global South now, because, you know, if I look at the arena that I work in, which is urban areas, your cities are old. You've got, you know, infrastructure that needs replacing and so on. So you've got a tidal wave of developmental need coming through. We need to put development right at the center of our argumentation, with climate change co-benefits, because that's how you attract people's attention. When they can see themselves in the story, they can see their personal needs being met. It's pointless talking about an invisible gas to people who don't have clean water or don't have energy security. And that for me is the change. Over the time I've worked in this field, I've seen those two agendas separate. Climate change has gone one way, development has gone another, and the time has come back. You know, we need to come back to the point where those two things are in the same room, but where development is our focus. I mean, if you think about it, just from a human settlements perspective, we could have 3 billion people living in informal settlements by the middle of the century at a time of overshoot, so a time of those extreme events being longer duration, more intense, more frequent. That's a tipping point no one is talking about. And you can only deal with that if you've got a developmental solution in your back pockets.
I think that's a fantastic point, because I think it's not just that those two have gone off into separate directions. They're often even framed as opposing, that there can only be one or the other. But I'm still wondering, how do you go against money, as a big term, to not make it more concrete, because that might be a bit too political?
No, and that's the thing. And I think, as I said to you, I don't think it's only money now. I think it's money that's got into bed with politics is a new challenge for us to deal with. But I believe if, you know, we pick up on this idea that we centralize development and we start speaking to the majority of people who are feeling alienated and, you know, on the periphery of society because their needs are not being met. I think if we come to those alienated elements of society with a strong development narrative that focuses on well-being, on safety, on livelihoods, on health, I think that's a compelling argument. And that's the wonderful thing is, you know, people can, through their votes, change systems. But we've got to bring people with us. And I fear that climate change science has not necessarily brought the majority of people with us. And so that's where I think we need to aim.
It's quite daunting, all of the things we've talked about. It's very difficult to maintain hope in all of the scenarios and challenges we've discussed. But you also said you're not a big believer in hope. Can you maybe explain your take on hope?
No, so I don't like the word hope, and I don't like the word despair, because for me, this is a time where, as I read the science and drawing on my knowledge of the world of practice, for me, the big message is, even in a world of overshoot, the game doesn't change. We have to be doing so much more around adaptation, so much more around mitigation, so much more around losses and damages, so much more improving equity and justice, that this is the time of hard work. I don't personally have time to focus on whether I'm hopeful or I'm not hopeful. To me, that's wasted time. For me, productive time is thinking about how we increase our commitments and the work that we're doing towards those aims in order to do more. You know, for me, that's the big message.
I think a lot of people listening to this podcast will probably be scientists, people who are already quite aware in this field and in this topic. But for those listening that maybe have less of a scientific background or less of an overview, what can they contribute to this hard work? Because of course we can all, you know, watch our energy consumption, eat less meat, buy secondhand clothing, a lot of things like that. But my personal feeling is always a bit, it's also not entirely fair to put the responsibility on individuals for systemic problems. So what would you advise individuals who want to contribute, who want to do the hard work? How can they contribute?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, we're in a scenario where every individual has to do all the things that you've said, because everything will count. But you're entirely right. I mean, you and I are not going to be able to build big green infrastructure by ourselves. You know, governments have to do that. And so, you know, it goes back to our discussion around democracy and so on. We've got to be able not only to, within the realm of our individual selves and our households, to make the kind of changes you've spoken about, because we all have to be contributing in order to make the kind of transformative change, but where you're able to vote, you need to be voting leadership into power who is capable of making those bigger decisions around where, you know, country resources go, the sort of infrastructure we build out, who benefits from that infrastructure, you know, around the risk prevention, about moves to greener economies and so on. So we've got to be thinking about that, because you're entirely right. At the individual level, there are glass ceilings. There's only so much we can do from home. But we need to use our extended power by virtue of the governance systems we find ourselves in to begin to change the leadership who, in fact, have the powers to change some of the bigger systems. So it requires us to be, I suppose, an activist as individuals, but activists in other spheres as well. You know, and very often I've inserted myself into processes where, quite frankly, I had no legitimate right to be, just simply to try and break open new doors to get those discussions going. So I think the big message is you've got to be brave. You've got to keep running at the wall. You may not get over it the first time round, but that shouldn't stop you running back and trying a second time round. And it's consistency. It's bravery. You know, once you've managed to get over the wall and into the room, stay in the room, change the conversation that's being held in that room, change the conversation in your social circles. So there's no silver bullet here, but we need to be looking at all the fronts that we can influence because of the scale that is coming. But at the same time, I'm also pragmatic and realistic and realizing that we may not be able to get that big sea change that we need, that big transformation, which is why I think this conference is so important, because it allows us to open up also a pragmatic discussion. We'll do our very best, but there are countervailing forces. If we don't achieve those big changes, what is our risk landscape? How do we deal with it? Because the world is not going to end, but we've got to keep options on the table as we move through that more difficult and challenged future.
Great. Thank you so much for your answer. I think that's also a really good ending to this episode. That's it. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. And thanks for putting me in.
I really, really enjoyed this talk. So, yeah. Thanks for taking the time and have a nice day. And I'm really interested to hear what the results are of the discussion you'll have at the conference.
You and me both.
Okay, great.
Ciao, Brenda.
Bye. Thank you. Thanks so much for tuning into the Overshoot podcast. Make sure to check out our other episodes. And if you want to stay up to date on the next episodes coming out, make sure to follow our podcast.